Dated, the date is June 14, 1983. This is the second lecture in a series of lectures by Roger Weir on the mystic century. Tonight's lecture is entitled Dante, 1265 to 1321, The Divine Comedy, the Architecture of the Interior Temple.
Mysticism has an odd place in our civilization at the current moment. We seem to be at one of those points of low ebb, the nadir, and yet all indications, if the patterns of long-term history are any accurate indication, the 21st century will be one of the great mystical centuries of all time, so that the individuals that we're dealing with now and for the next 10 sessions will reoccur as fabulous individuals, as models of activity, as sages to be consulted. So it's of great interest for us, those of you who have been attending the Thursday night lecture series on the great scientific and cultural revolutions of the 12th century, the 1100s, and for those of you who were here for the previous series on Tuesday night, that took Hermetic science from Ficino through to Isaac Newton, this particular course will have an extra added meaning because it is the link between the fabulous 12th century and the Renaissance in northern Italy in Ficino's time, about 1450. The last figure that we take in this series is Thomas a Kempis, who lives to be a very old man and lives on until 1471, so that a Kempis is available as a living individual for those persons like Ficino who began the movement of Hermetic science. So in a way, this mystical century has a quality of reverberation, much like mystical form would have. That is to say, its shape of phenomenal existence does not stop just at the presentational form, but it has a further reverberation, like a parenthetical vibration echoing the phenomenal reality in a disappearing arabesque of transcendental noumenal reality. The perception of this vibrational echoing in all the individuals in this course led them as practical mystical individuals to consider well their own place in the cosmos in terms of the vibrational integrities that were set in motion by their own understanding. We saw last time with Rumi how an architecture of meaning of great proportions was engendered through his experiments with mystical language, and how the Masnavi in some 1,500, 1,600 pages developed the scope of a mystical epic. Rumi, dying in 1273, having had contact with the great Sufi sage Ibn Arabi, especially through the stepson of Ibn Arabi from his third wife, seemed to bring together this whole notion of language being capable of floating, an epic mystical structure introduced into European mentality at the time in the 1270s, the 1280s, the expectation that there was a capacity for a mystical epic in their own languages, but that the proper preparation for this was the path which Rumi had taken, and that was to write love poetry. And in fact, in recognizing that the feelings of love raised from the personal level to the religious universal level was not only true of the Persian mystical poets, Rumi as the great example of that, there were many others, but that it was further true of that last great sage of antiquity, Virgil, whose epic, the Aeneid, had given the last great epic structure to civilization, and recovering Virgil's works increasingly in their integrity, making fresh translations from newly recovered manuscripts, they were surprised and pleased and informed to discover that Virgil had cut his teeth, literally, on writing not only love poems, but bucolic poems about nature, so that in the first great poetic structures of Virgil, the Georgics and the Eclogues, we find increasingly Virgil using the natural sight, the natural hearing, the natural tones of love relationality to women, to comrades, to the world of nature, preparing him increasingly for a vision which was inclusive of these reverberations on into transcendental noumenal reality. And in fact, if we can progress beyond the textbook versions of what Virgil presented, if we go into the Aeneid, we find there many sections of almost ultimate composite mysticism. And when we become informed of the background, and incidentally I did a lecture on the mysticism of Virgil about 2 years ago at the PRS, we discover that Virgil was one of the great mystical occult voices of his time, and that in fact the authority for writing his great epic came from Augustus, the great Roman emperor, Augustus' desire to collect in one set of hands, his own, all of the occult powers of the known world, so that he could, in effect, close the doors of the Temple of Janus for the first time in about 300 years. The Temple of Janus had two sets of doors, and it was like a metaphysical threshold of power in the world. And when the world was at peace, the doors on both sides could be closed, so that there was a sense of presence in Rome of a harmonia of the entire world. Augustus called this the Pax Romana. And in addition to closing the doors of the Temple of Janus, and so insistent was Augustus that three times in 2 years he closed the doors and outbreaks would happen somewhere distant in the empire, he would rush legions there and quell the disturbance and restructure the situation, bring in not only troops but emigres so that he could go back and close the doors again. And the third time it stuck. And at this time he ordered built in Rome, in the center of the Forum, amidst all the sacred buildings, the sacred temple of world vision, wherein he caused murals, sculptural murals, of the procession of man's mystical attainment to be executed. And of course these were done exactly at the time when Jesus was alive in Israel, so that the Auris Pacem is a world-class temple of man's vision. And in order to send the reverberation of this temple of peace and the closed doors of the Temple of Janus out into the world, he personally commissioned the greatest poetic voice of his age, Virgil, to write an epic poem, the Aeneid, to carry the meaningfulness of his actions out into the entire world. This great structure had preparatory to its development in Virgil the concern with love poetry, so that learning the language of love is not the paltry, insipid thing that we think today, but is rather the beginnings of the insight into the fulcrum of that most mysterious process, which alone can be the keystone in the arch of triumph of human understanding. A keystone not of some objective thing, but of the capacity to recognize the significance of the entire durational flow of phenomenal reality, why it occurs in the first place, and that the keystone for this is the recognition that the innermost gathering of powers of ourselves lies in a focus of forces which is interchangeable with another, and that the occurrence of the beloved, of the loved one, is conclusive proof, is experimental recognition in the nth degree of the fact that our inmost self does not belong to us exclusively, but is an exchangeable sense of presence with another human being, with a beloved one, and that that being so, man recognizes in his aspiration that that is true between himself and God, and that the highest order of transposition in the universe is that God enters man and man enters God in one transpositional act of consecration. So that love poetry is the natural beginnings of tutoring our sensitivities and tutoring our angles of perception, tutoring our sense of the tapestry of the all, how the phenomenal realm becomes an arch, a threshold, a portal that kept into place metaphysically, mystically, by our sense of transpositional reality, we may then pass through and enter another realm. This consideration and all of the others that I have mentioned, plus countless ramifications, became the rage in Italy in the middle of the 13th century. And it occurred increasingly to the great poetic voices of that time that in the first meanderings of the troubadours, in the first brave attempts of the lyrical poetry of Petrarch and Boccaccio, were actually the fruitful beginnings of a coming triumphal celebration in some epic form of this great movement which had happened not only with Rumi and the Persian poets, but with Virgil and the Roman poets. So that we have, at the time that Dante was born, about 1265 in Florence, a population of individuals who were trying to bring out of themselves the manifestation of the time in terms of writing love poetry. It's interesting to note that one of Dante's greatest friends, Guido Cavalcanti, was also one of the great sonnet writers of his day. And in fact, when Dante was growing up and realizing his companionship with Cino and Cavalcanti and others like that, he began to recognize that in his life there had been an instance of transcendental love seated in his own experience, and that if he could only bring this experience to the fore in his consciousness, in his discursive quality of recognizing significance, in terms of his active intellect, that this potentiality in that seed experience could be nurtured and grown. And it's rather like the notion of a seed being given a chance to be nourished, and out of this seed, through patience, grows the mighty tree, the mighty oak, the mighty tree of life. And this mystical template of culturing and nourishing the seed of such an experience of transcendental love, to its large tree-like structure, occurred to Dante when he was about 28 years of age. Now, 28 is one of those formative periods in a human life. A couple years, give or take, 28 is a transitional age where the powers of integration suddenly rise almost asymptotically, and one realizes that the images which were so glib when you were 19 or 20 suddenly become devastating in their capacity to reverberate. Because it is exactly then, at that time, that our mystical capacity becomes real to us, in a sense that it begins to bridge from ourselves to the world. And if we are unprepared for it, of course, this can be a shattering experience. For Dante, in order to take stock of himself at this time, he wrote a book called The New Life. And it was written in 1294, so he was about 29 when he actually finished it. And in The New Life, Dante recalls this early experience. That in fact it had happened, he says, when he was nearing the end of his ninth year, and the girl that he saw was beginning her ninth year. He was literally walking down the street when his eye caught the form of a girl about his age. But it wasn't just the girl that he saw, but it was a full seed image of the wholeness of his inner self, of his inner soul, of that heart space wherein this seed of recognition took root immediately upon sight and began to grow. And how it grew was through these reverberational parentheses of noumenal occurrence, so that Dante became immediately transfixed by the experience. He began to daydream about the girl every day. He began to take long walks to try and go by her house. He began to dream up little scenarios of meeting her, of at least seeing her. But it was never the practical issue of boy meets girl. It was a metaphysical maze wandering of the quester seeking a center in a labyrinth, so that he never once talked to directly this girl whose name was Beatrice, Beatrice or Beatrice. And it turned out that he did not actually see her directly again until she was 18 years of age. And he was then walking down one of the streets of Florence, and here she came between two older women, and she was dressed in white, and she looked exactly at him. And this set off the occurrences all over again on an even deeper level, from what he had experienced at age 9 and now at age 18, almost 19, Dante began to be possessed again by this anima archetypal experience. And all of the occurrences of his life, which had been ordered somewhat in a phenomenal way, were disordered and distorted because they were being polarized and magnetized and reordered in terms of a noumenal landscape which was transpersonal. And of course, Dante, like any individual, without experience, without masters in this regard, completely disoriented. Within 2 years, Beatrice actually married another man, a very famous, wealthy man of the Bardi family, Simeon de Bardi. And Dante was present at the wedding, and he was so distracted that he caused a scene, and many people thought that he was perhaps going crazy. And in order to establish a protectiveness for his metaphysical love for this woman, so as not to sully by worldly concerns or by the gossip that might come up in terms of worldly issues, he began to make all kinds of overtures to another woman, writing poems, writing sonnets about her. And in this regard, all of this is confessed in The New Life by Dante. In this regard, Dante managed to defend the sacredness of the image of Beatrice, so that the truth of his love, in terms of the image, the imago of his heart, the sacred image in his heart, was protected by its secretness, by its mystical sealed integrity. The father of Beatrice, a man named Focal Polinari, very famous at his time, died. Dante wrote a wonderful sonnet to him, and in it seemed to forecast the early death of Beatrice. And within 6 months of her father, she also died. So that Dante began to experience in his life a kind of metaphysical anguish, that he had somehow a personal, direct, transcendental link to this woman, that the very qualities of the integrity of his soul in terms of a universal manifestation were tied by a metaphysical umbilical to the conditions of this woman. And of course, her death, on the surface, in a phenomenal way, seemed to indicate to him that he need do everything he could to protect the sacredness of that mystical marriage which he had experienced with her through just the look of the eyes. It's very important to recognize and focus on how important the glance is. The glance to establish contact, and the direct gaze to create the flow of contact. So that all through Dante, whenever you find him rising up to a mystical, powerful language, it is always choreographed by the line of sight. So that in Dante, landscapes and architectures and cosmic structures are all important in terms of lines of vision, so that of course in the ultimate vision of God, they are all brought together in a floral rosette of a celestial flower formed by the wings of the angels, all arranged in increasing spirals around a center, so that all the lines of vision are brought together and unified, so that the eyes and the line of vision, the line of sight, is both structural for Dante and metaphorical. And the way in which the eye goes is the cue, the leading clue, by which to follow Dante through all the convolutions of his meaning. And when we get to portions of the Divine Comedy, you'll see it can get extremely complicated. Beatrice had died at age 24, the prime of her life. Dante had then felt that somehow he had to save himself from the increasing destructive polarities that were coming out in him. And so he admits in The New Life that he had to set aside his religious visionary capacity. In order to save himself, he had to set it aside. And he says, instead of this, I took up philosophy, the love of philosophy, the love of going into the joys of the wisdom of the mind in all of its infinite detail and all of its luxuriant elegance in order to save myself. So that he went from theology to philosophy. And he records in the Paradiso that there are in fact two, a double beatitude to man's condition in reality. That in pointed distinction to the philosophic theology of St. Thomas Aquinas, who maintained that there was but one beatitude, Dante specifically says there are two, that there is a philosophic wisdom and there is a theological faith, and that these two exist together. And later on, Dante will try to maintain that the double order of the Franciscans, started by St. Francis of Assisi, and the Dominicans, started by St. Dominic, brought to great intellectual prominence, respectively, by the Franciscans, by Robert Grosseteste and Roger Bacon, and the Dominicans, by Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas, that in fact, these two orders braid themselves in physical reality so that they interchange their core presences and establish a unity by virtue of the doubling of the Beatitudes. This is quite distinct from the Thomistic integration in the Summa Theologica, where everything is unified to one. In Dante, it is like the Hermetic Caduceus, where there are two, and because they are able to intertwine and interchange, they create a unity. In fact, in the Paradiso, in cantos 11 and 12, is where Dante presents this most arcane understanding of Christian history, where he has, speaking for the Dominicans, the figure of Bonaventure, Saint Bonaventure, who was the great Franciscan of his time. Bonaventure wrote a great life of Saint Francis. But in the Paradiso, Dante has Bonaventure writing in behalf of the Dominicans. And then he has a great Dominican writing in behalf of the Franciscans, Thomas Aquinas. So that Aquinas is presenting the Franciscan view and Bonaventure the Dominican view. And the only way in order to understand that in terms of Dante's position in the Paradiso is that there has been an exchange of inner presences of the two orders, thought to be polarities on earth, but seen in Dante's heavenly vision to be exchangeable centers and thus integrated in heaven. All this is recorded and initiated in The New Life, which appeared about 1294. Dante, at this time, became married. He had two sons and a daughter. One of his sons, Jacopo, in fact, would be the one who would discover the final 13 cantos of the Divine Comedy and thus publish them and make a completion of his father's work. The daughter was named Beatrice. Beatrice, Beatrice, the same as a little girl. And here's a psychic manifestation to pay attention to. Very often, in terms of a man's phenomenal reality, he will behave to his daughter as he did to his mother, so that in his present generation, he balances somewhat unconsciously the parental image with the daughter image, so that the mother and the daughter form a vibrational continuum from his phenomenal self. Very often, for a man to understand his fullness as a spiritual being, he has to make his peace with the image of the mother and the image of the daughter. And of course, this ancient archetypal ceremonial imagery is presented in all of its clarity by the Greek cult of Demeter and Persephone, the mother and the daughter. And the initiate goes in and is initiated at Eleusis because of the mother and daughter as a tandem, the fruitfulness of the earth and the return of its fruitfulness through the next generation. And of course, the contrapositive of this is true of women, of the feminine phenomenal psyche. It is the father and it is the son. So Dante's daughter was named Beatrice, Beatrice. The visionary girl had died. Dante had become one of the great promising young writers in Florence. His sonnets were increasingly read with great dignity and excellence by the leading poets of the day. He was married, he was having children. He became enamored of politics. And of course, the Florence of his day was consumed with a passion for politics. The two parties, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, which had their origins and their names in Germanic family lore, which had come in through Frederick Barbarossa and Frederick II to dominate the Italian political scene. The corrosive innuendos of politics in Florence, according to the great historian of Florence, Niccolo Machiavelli, who aside from the Discourses and the Prince wrote a great history of Florence, in which he said that Florence was constantly like a pot of stew boiling over. Yet never, ever during the Renaissance period had any real stability. There were constantly wars between different cliques and factions, between the rich and the poor, between the artisans and the other bank guilds. Every conceivable type of factioning of human behavior was represented in Florence, and they all disliked each other. So Dante entered into this most fascinating worldly realm. He, in fact, seemed to enjoy philosophy, to enjoy politics, to enjoy his family life, until a great period of disenchantment set in. Dante found himself condemned to be burnt at the stake, and along with about a dozen others, fled the city of Florence and began to live in other cities in northern Italy. He went to Padua, to Mantua, to Pisa, and rumor has it he even went to Paris for a while. He eventually settled in Ravenna, and it was there that he died in 1321. While he was traveling, the old visionary capacity kept returning to him, and in his maturity, he records at the beginning of the Divine Comedy, and incidentally, it wasn't called divine until the 17th century. In his Commedia, he records that lost in the great forest of life at the midway point, feeling that he was beyond salvation, he came upon the vision, the guide, of the great seer of antiquity, Virgil. And this great guide, this monumental seer of the bridge between this world and the other, the interior transcendental realms, began to appear for Dante almost on the heels of the vision of a fierce lion in this forest, which pounces and roars before Dante, so that this fierce imagery of beast-like bestial challenge followed by the guide appearing, the heavenly guide appearing, is repeated later on in the last cantos of the Purgatorio, so that the beginning of the Divine Comedy, which is a three-part structure, the Inferno, the Purgatorio, and then the Paradiso, at the beginning of the Inferno, we have a condition which is repeated at the end of the Purgatorio, so that the phenomenal realms of the underworld and the limbo of the Purgatorio are held between two great parenthetical parallels, and is only by bringing these two realms and this parallelism, this parenthetical unity, into a harmony, into an expiational feeling tone of unity, that Dante can then proceed on to the heavenly realms. And not only that, but Virgil as a guide can only take him through this Inferno and Purgatorio realms. He must have a new guide, another guide, a different sort of guide to enter into paradise. And in fact, the key to the Divine Comedy are the last five cantos of the Purgatorio. It, like the Inferno, has 33 cantos, and all of the lines in the Divine Comedy are divided into three-part rhymes, terza rima, the three rhymes in every line, so that the image of triads permeates exquisitely the structural literary reality of the Divine Comedy. But the last five cantos of the Purgatorio are the mystical vision of transition and transposition in which Dante shows his universal genius. And it is there that we need to go for some specifics. It's almost impossible to find any exposition of the Divine Comedy these days that centers in on this. So I give this to you because the more mundane qualities you can find in any guidebook. But this is very difficult to come across. It begins with Canto 28 of the Purgatorio, and we are again in a dense forest. Only it so happens that instead of being a wild wood in which Dante is lost as a phenomenal person, unbeknownst to him, he has now entered into the archetypally fabulous Garden of Eden, and that the Garden of Eden, in this case, is a vast primordial forest uninhabited by humankind. And in several places, the angelic beings that come to see him note the fact that this grand, great forest, which is the natural abode for man, has been empty since the fall of Adam. And we are given to understand that the appearance of Virgil and Dante at this juncture of heaven and earth is a summation of the significance of all time since Adam. And that, in fact, Dante now represents increasingly an accumulation of historical polarities and metaphysical magnetic lines of significance, so that through these five cantos, increasingly, the burden of recognition of the value which he increasingly represents by his achievement and his accomplishment begins to make of him a universal talisman of man's possibility for resurrection into the paradise. Not a resurrection through the particular sufferings of the cross, so much as the resurrection of man's capacities to bring back into focus in himself all of the noumenal reverberations which had been so spread out throughout the universe, throughout history, and throughout time, that they had lost all connection with the phenomenal appearance of man, and now we're being brought back and accruing, so that Dante becomes, in effect, a humanistic savior of man, by whose pioneering step and journey every man may come through this journey and this portal with him to the paradise. It is almost bordering, at the time when he wrote this, 1300, on a sacrilegious disposition. So Dante, in order to convey the fact that he, as a man, as a conscious, humanistically based intellectual man, has very little control over this transformation, that in fact the guide all the way for him, Virgil, the civilized prototype of the great epic writing sage who makes a civilization and is unable to carry him any further, and Dante as the representative of earth created man, intellectually created man, literary man, rising up on his greatest aspiration, is brought to the point of helpless tears and shameful repentance at his inadequacies. So at the very point at which Dante could have made a sacrilegious figure of himself as man triumphantly emerging by his own step from hell, from confusion before it on the earth, from the rising up of the great spiraling mound of Purgatorio, he does not step into paradise by his own step, but needs then give over to a new guide all of his capacities. And the new guide is none other than the woman, Beatrice, who descends from heaven to see whether or not he can give over his sense of presence to herself, can enter into this mystical marriage with her, can accept her deepest presence into himself, and give over his deepest presence to her. All this accentuated almost to a point of engendering a psychopathic tremendousness within the character and the mental and physical capacity of Dante. He's brought to the point of mysterium tremendous, where he will either shake apart and break, or he will permit the transposition because he has learned to let go. So he is brought increasingly in these five cantos by Dante with great wonderful artistry to the psychological point where he will either have to exchange or he will break. So he begins this last great movement towards the other end of the parentheses, much as he had begun at the beginning of the Inferno. And he records here, this is a translation from Charles Singleton at Princeton. I like this translation. Eager now to search within and round about the divine forest, green and dense, which tempered the new day to my eyes, without waiting longer, I left the bank, taking the level ground very slowly over the soil that everywhere gives forth fragrance. Everywhere that he steps, the very soil, the ground of this forest, gives forth a perfuming, a fragrance. It is the presence of the Holy Spirit that perfumes the air, as it were, the ether, as it were, the quintessence of the elements, as it were, is a sure mystical sign, as we will see, of being on the path. This fragrance of the Holy Spirit, which seems to perfume and permeate all phenomenal reality, everywhere he walks. A sweet breeze that had no variation in itself, was striking on my brow with the force only of a gentle wind. It had no movement, no variation in itself, so that it is presented as the wind of unity, not in its phenomenal, violent manifestation as the Ruach, the holy divine wind of God, which appears in all primordial earth religious experiences, that of Abraham and that of the Navajos. You always find the holy wind as a phenomenal manifestation of God, God's primordial presence. Dante is feeling this, but now he's feeling it in a capacity where it's just a gentle wind on his brow. It is a tapping to open up to this unity. This gentle wind by which the fluttering boughs all bent freely toward the quarter where the holy mountain casts its first shadow. In other words, Dante is arriving at that point where the mountain comes together and where its shadow cast also comes together. It's like an hourglass between light and dark, between thing and shadow. And this breeze of unity is bowing, as in prayer, the vegetation of the Garden of Eden towards that focus, so that Dante immediately makes this cosmic X in all creation, and there at the point where the Mount of Purgatory touches the first opening of heaven is the focal point towards which Dante is now moving, still guided by Virgil, but increasingly Virgil is fading into the background, so that he says, all these boughs bent freely toward the quarter where the holy mountain casts its first shadow, yet they were not so deflected from their upright state that the little birds among the tops ceased practicing all their arts, but their singing greeted the morning hours with full joy among the leaves, which kept such burden to their rhymes. So the birds are singing, the birds of paradise are still singing. So Dante going there, and then recognizing that as he's moving towards this focal point, that as he is moving, he has moved to a point where he sees a woman, not Beatrice, but a woman named Matilda, who is across the stream, and she is a gorgeous apparition for him, not so much in physical cosmetic beauty, but with the integrated gentleness by which she fits in to the place in which Dante finds himself. And he, looking at her, long practiced to seeing this feminine archetypal image of wholeness, recognizes that she is singing a song which is of the nature of the reality of this place. And so he motions to her to come closer, and in doing so realizes that there is a little stream that flows through this forest, and that she is just on the other side of this stream from himself. And in fact, looking at the stream, he sees himself reflected in that stream like a mirror, his left side, so that in seeing her, she appears at the top of his image of his left side, so that he, in his reflection, is a bridge between himself as he experiences himself and her as he sees her. And they are moving in tandem along this stream together, and wherever the stream winds, they wind. And so this parenthetical shape is set in motion, this movement towards the focus of this axis of all the universe. And in this movement, Dante again and again uses the imagery of the air. And he says now that he notices that, in fact, this breeze is like the sirocco. It's like the hot wind coming up. And the imagery begins to build so that one has air, which when it moves becomes wind, moves in such a way that after it moves it becomes flame, that the air moving as wind catches fire and becomes flame. And again, this kind of transpositional imagery haunts these final cantos, so that everywhere is the quality of presence as in air, and then movement within that presence as in wind, and then flaming into realization as in fire. And then as the fire flames up, Dante realizes that there is some mystical explosiveness in the recognition of what the flame brings. And he finds within himself a deep simpatico with that which the flame brings. So that he finally, asking if he may hear this song, she says to him, finally, "You are newcomers. You are newcomers. You've just gotten here. And perhaps why I am smiling in this place, chosen for the nest of the human race. Some doubt holds you wondering, but there are psalms that give light that may dispel the cloud from your minds." And Dante realizes now that his mind, his mental capacities are all transparent to her. And in fact, as he looks at her, and the canto comes along and comes to a close, she says, "They who in olden times sang of the age of gold and its happy state, perhaps in Parnassus, dreamed of this place. Here the root of mankind was innocent. Here is always spring and every fruit. This is the nectar of which each tells." Dante says, "I turned then round to my poets and saw that with a smile they had heard these last words. Then to the fair lady I turned my face." And she goes on singing. And as she is singing, he experiences in the sound of her words, which moves like a intelligible wind upon the air, an experience, he says, that's very much like lightning, only instead of lightning just occurring and then waning, it's lightning that increases. And the sense that there is lightning around him waxing introduces to him the experience that some tremendous uplift of energy has seized the situation. And in this increasing lightning-like atmosphere of light perception, he turns to look and he sees coming a vision of a mystical entourage coming through paradise, through this deep, dense, primal forest. And as it comes, he describes it with a increasing sense of awe. And for this, because it's very difficult to make sense out of this part of the translation, I take us to the H.F. Carey translation at the beginning of Canto 30 of the Purgatorio. Carey did this translation early in the 19th century, and in this particular instance, he's superior to the singleton, so I'll come to Carey. Why? Here's how Singleton translates it. "When the wane of the first heaven, which never knew setting or rising, or veil of other cloud than of sin, and which there made each one aware of his duty, even as the lower wane guides him who turns the helm to come into port, had stopped still, the truthful people who had first come between the griffin and it turned to the chariot as to their peace." It's very hard to make sense of what he is saying. So I come here to Carey. And what Dante has seen is a chariot with great wheels being pulled by a griffin. And the symbolic Christian figure of a griffin, which is part eagle and part lion, is of a twofold nature. It's an animal, a chimera, technically, but it has a twofold nature. It has the eagle, which is the lord of the air, of the wind, of song, of that which would bring the flame, and of the lion, who is the king of the earth, of the beasts, of that which comes from below. So above and below, the eagle and the lion, who individually may also be very fierce. Nothing is more fierce in the air above than the eagle. And St. John was the gospel of the eagle. And nothing is more ferocious than the lion of Mark, the gospel of Mark. So that Mark and John really are the protectors of the integrity of the gospel. Mark, of course, went from Rome, where he was the interpreter of St. Peter. After Peter was martyred, Mark went to Alexandria because he was the one who could teach the Alexandrians. He was tough, as a lion is tough. And John, of course, the visionary for the long future, the millennial ages to come, because he was the eagle. He was able to rise to great heights of insight. So the eagle and the lion together form the griffin. And it is this image, this twofold beast, who pulls this fabulous chariot. And the chariot has on one side, one wheel, three maidens who are symbolically arrayed. One of them is red in color, like a burnt crimson. The other is an emerald green, just the opposite. And the third is a pure milk white, so that you have the red, white, and green of these three maidens. And on the other wheel of the chariot, there are four maidens who are all dressed in a royal purple, and they always move so that they are creating a center between them. So the four of them always create a centering, and the other three always create a ripple of reverberation between the opposites and the equilibrium, the red and the green and the white. So that in this iridescent entourage, and behind there are other figures, 24 elders who come two by two, so you have 12 pairs. And along with this chariot being drawn by the griffins and guarded parenthetically by the choreographed three maidens and the four maidens and the entourage behind, in the chariot, unseen by Dante at first, is the most fearsome, highly charged, energized presence. And he doesn't see right away, because it is so energized, so highly potently there, that he can't record it, that his feelings, his sensitivity, his mind records a negative space because of so much integration in that figure. And only when he is tuned enough that he begins to be able to see in glances that figure, he realizes that it is Beatrice. But she is colored like an iridescent flame. She is a flame being. And her eyes are so intuitively powerful that he dare not look at her. That he is just in orienting himself to a glance of her is almost destroyed in this tremulousness that comes over him. So that he begins to focus himself again, as he did with the other woman, he begins to look down, and he's trying to find in the median ground between him and it, between him and that, between what he is and that other, some basic ground. And as he's looking down, he notices this stream rippling through, the same stream that he saw Matilda on the other side. Only this time the stream seems to run over the ground, over the grasses, so that they are all bent in this waveform ripple of some kind of a stream or flow of integrity. And in that stream, in that miraculous water that flows over land and in air, in this phenomenal concurrence of all the elements, he recognizes that he must look up. He must see her. But in order to orient himself to being able to do this, he has to conceive to himself some kind of an orientation in his experience. And so he's searching for an orientation. How may I conceive this incredible event so that I may participate in it? He has to have a structure. And so Canto 30 begins, and we couldn't make sense out of it with the Singleton translation, but look how Carey handles this. He makes a vision in terms of polar light, like the guide star Polaris, this polar light. He says, soon as that polar light, fair ornament of the first heaven, which has never known setting nor rising, nor the shadowy veil of cloud other than man's sin, to duty there, each one convoying, as that lower does, where the steersman guides himself to port by the firmly fixed star, forthwith the saintly tribe who in the van behind this griffin and its radiance came, did turn them to the car as to the rest. So that all the figures, he's saying, all the figures surrounding this car, Dante begins to concentrate on them, and as he does, he notices that they orient themselves geometrically towards the car that the griffin is pulling. And so with this guide, with this cue, with this structure, Dante can bring himself to bear to recognize that what is happening is that some great primordial cosmic ordering is happening before his very experience, and that he is a part of this experience, so much a part that he will not exist unless he participates in that experience, so that his very existence, his very nature as a viable being at any time in the universe is all dependent upon him participating there and now in that increasing geometry of meaning shaping and taking place right before his eyes. And as he does so, his cue and his guide is this intellectual structure of the threes and the fours, of the seven, of the twos, of the chariot, of the fact of the griffin, and all of this, and finally he is able to look and see. And when he looks up at her, she looking at him unsmilingly devastates him by a direct glance. And Dante, for a second, looking away, looking for Virgil, looking for his guide, and Virgil is not there. He's gone. The great epic sages of antiquity have taken him as far as he can go. They've never been where he is. They couldn't go where he is. He's on new ground, terra incognita. And so he realizes that he is left alone, suspended. All the qualities of the existential alienation hit Dante in that moment, and he realizes that the only place he can look is back to that center of devastation, back to Beatrice's eyes. And looking back, he looks up to her just as she calls out to him, do not look for your old guide. Virgil is gone. And you tremble because you have not yet the unity within yourself to stand firm and float free and be with me as I am. And she says, this is impossible for you now, except with my help. I will lead you through this paradisical condition, through this primordial forest where you are lost again, but instead of on the beginning level, you're lost at the highest pinnacle of your possible attainment. And only a spirit guide can help you here. And I am that, and yet you cannot look at me. you cannot be here with me as I am. There is a fount here from which two rivers flow, the Tigris and the Euphrates, or the Lethe, the river of forgetfulness of past sins, and the other river which is always forgotten in our day and age, the Eunoe, E-U-N-O-E. So there are two rivers. There's one of forgetfulness, but not a forgetfulness of everything, forgetfulness of the sting of past sins. And the other river is a nourishing liquor, elixir, ambrosia, which fortifies the good. The Lethe and the Eunoe together, and you have to take them in that order. You have to be able to take the Lethe. You have to let go of that sinful past reverberation, and you have to accept that fortification of the good reverberation. Only then can you make this transition from the limbo of transcendental purgatory to the lightning manifestation of paradise as it really exists in a beyond from any phenomenal condition you could imagine. And what you have to let go of is all that reverberational baggage which you have imagined, which will forbid you from going into paradise. And at the same time that you let go of that, you have to come full round present here now and look your spirit guide in the eye. And it's the one place in the universe he does not want to look, because he does want to look so terribly badly there that it scares him to death to think that he could. He drinks of Lethe and looks up, and he realizes that it's totally harmless, that Beatrice is the woman he loved, not just as a woman, but as a spirit-soul companion. And he says to her, how could I have been so foolish as to be fearful for you of looking at you? And she, turning to rainbow-colored flame before his eyes, now seen as a beautiful harmonia, says, before you had not drunk of Lethe, but you are going to have to go back to earth. You're going to have to go back and write to mankind this way of transformation. So I give you of Lethe now, temporarily, and now we give you of Eunoe temporarily, so that you may come into paradise, and you will record there, not in your mind, but in your transcendent spiritual being, the conditions which you find there. And so, at the end of the purgatorial, he records, the seven ladies stopped at the edge of a pale shade, such as beneath green leaves and dark boughs the mountains cast over their cold streams. In front of them, it seems to me, I saw Euphrates and Tigris issue from one fountain and, like friends, slowly part from one another. O light, O glory of the human race, what water is this that pours from here one source and from itself withdraws itself? It's like the vision of Mount Kailas in the Himalayas, the way in which the Brahmaputra and the Indus come from the same Lake Manasarar, the very same kind of an image. That holy mount of purgatory, like Mount Kailas, is a center from which the streams of life, like friends, slowly part and come round full to make the condition of man in the phenomenal world in the arms of their parentheses, so that what we think is real is only occurring within the scope of a cosmic wholeness. And throughout this, Dante gives the image of a dance. All these maiden forms are always dancing, and there's a sense of the choreography of the posture of moving freely in the air. To my question, she replied, He asks, how does it withdraw? As itself, in itself, thus. To my question, she replied, ask Matilda to tell you. And here the beautiful lady answered, as one freeing herself from blame. This and other things I have told him, and I am certain that Lethe's water did not hide it from him. And Beatrice then says to Dante, and he can hear her now, without trembling, he's ready. He's ready to be with her as she is. She says, and perhaps some greater care, which often robs the memory, has darkened the eyes of his mind. But see, Eunoe, that flows forth here, bring him there too, and as you are wont, revive his weakened faculties. As a gentle spirit that makes no excuse, but makes its will of another's will, as soon as that is disclosed by outward sign, so the fair lady, after I was taken by her, moved on, and with womanly grace, she says, come. And then he says, to us. If, reader, I had greater space for writing, I would yet, even yet, be singing about the sweet draught, the sweet drink, which never would have sated me. But since all the pages ordained for this second canticle are filled, the curb of art lets me go no further. In other words, the structure is complete. He dare not go further. His imagination cannot go beyond the bounds of the structures of the spirit. I came forth, he says, from those most holy waves, renovated, even as new trees renewed with new foliage, pure, and now ready to rise to the stars. And he has this vision where at this particular point of transcendence, where one may rise up to the paradise, that what he had seen originally as a peculiar group of trees, he now sees them as almost like seven giant candelabra, which are flame, rainbow flames, which he had thought they were trees at first. And that as he looks at them, he sees that they are not just giant flaming candelabra, but that they burn and wither through the phenomenal reality of what flame would be and leave, he says, a quality of painted air. And in that painted air, there's a presence, a twinkling, an otherness, which he now has adapted himself and he can see. And thus, the beginning of the Paradiso, he immediately transposes himself from one reality to another. And he says, and the Purgatorio ended that way, and the Paradiso begins this way. The glory of the All-Mover penetrates through the universe and reglows in one part more and another less. And I have been in this heaven that most receives of his light and have seen things which whoso descends from up there has neither the knowledge nor the power to relate, because as it draws near to its desire, our intellect enters so deep that memory cannot go back upon the track. Nevertheless, so much of the holy kingdom as I could treasure up in my mind shall now be the matter of my song. So that he's going to give us those reverberations after the transcendental flames have occurred, those impressions that are left, and that will be the Divine Comedy. And in order to facilitate this, Dante then, at this incredible juncture, puts in an appeal to the classical Apollo, interestingly enough. O good Apollo, for this last labor make me such a vessel of your worth as you require for granting your beloved laurel. Thus far, one peak of Parnassus has sufficed me, but now I have need of both as I enter the arena that remains. He's going to need both Beatitudes now. No matter how powerfully transcendent was the religious, the theological, he now, at this point of entering paradise, the paradiso, knows he's going to need the other also, of whom Apollo is the cue. He's going to need Christ and Apollo. He's going to need Beatrice and something else in order to sing this song and bring this structure into language. Because if he follows only Beatrice, there will be nothing phenomenal there to record. It will be a mystical experience of which there is no telling. There is no song. There are no words that could speak of it. So he's going to need the other Beatitude in order to make something there for us to follow. So the other Beatitude, the wisdom of philosophy, is the only clue that man ever has consciously to get through to paradise. Well, that's all for tonight. We'll have some